Feel old. Anyway, thank you to all of you for coming. Today I'm going to continue a talk that I present here in February. Many things are more established now, and many things are also quite different. And so essentially for people that were not here in February, the idea is that we want to explore the possibility that pure information may underlie all physics, not just quantum theory. And actually, we know that this information... Hi. There's a chair there. The information it should be made of quantum bits, not of classical bits. So it's a special kind of information. It's quantum information. Let me mention that just yesterday, Giulio posted on the web a paper that we finished with Paolo. Paolo Perinotti was visiting here last week. This is actually the end of a very long research line that started in 2003. So we have now a complete axiomatization of quantum theory with a whistle and a bell, since a very long paper. Is a 40 PRA style, physical review style pages paper, which actually is based largely on the previous published PRA, which is another 40 pages, so it's 80 pages, unfortunately, but there are all details of every proof. Everything is proved in very deep detail, and the result, very shortly, is that quantum theory is a kind of information, is an information theory. And I don't have time here to discuss this, and actually it's not even useful, because you have Giulio here, he's available to you, he can explain. And let me just mention one thing which is relevant for this talk, is that the operational framework, which is the framework of, which is at the basis of this derivation of quantum theory, is the most, and which is the framework that actually is common to many authors here, like Lucien, especially Chris, and also other authors like our Barnrum was here last year, and Alex Wills and many others, is essentially the general framework of any kind of information theory, is the framework of any information theory. And here there is an exercise of translation from the physical or operational language to the computer programming language. So what is the event? The event is just a subroutine. A transformation is an information processing, and an effect is a readout processing, a state is an initialization processing. A physical system is a register. So it's something on which we write or read the information. So this looks quite an academic exercise, but if you translate all the axioms in terms of this computer language, they become really very interesting, something that you have not seen before. So take a look at this paper. The paper actually doesn't work out this part. This is going to be another paper. But you can find the principles and the proof that quantum theory is an information theory in all respects. Sorry?
You said the paper doesn't work out.
The paper doesn't work out this translation. Oh. Yeah. This will be on another paper.
Okay. What's the difference between a transformation and an event?
The transformation.
This is not understand physics.
Yeah, physics and operational framework are synonymous here. And we are showing that operationalist and informationalist are also synonymous.
Forget that, son. What's the difference between a transformation and an event in physics?
The transformation and what?
You have two
events.
You have events.
Oh, yeah, no, you're right. Okay, this is, okay, then we go into details. The transformation actually is an equivalence class of events that occur with the same probability for all possible input and all possible outputs. I just give an idea here. I'm not entering in details. So if you want more details, then we can discuss.
What do you mean, what's the difference between an event and an effect, then?
Oh, the effect is the effect of Ludwig. So this is not any kind of... this is a special kind of transformation, which is a transformation from specific systems to the null system. So it's the readout, the outcome. And the state is a special kind of transformation.
So it's like a measurement, sort of?
Yeah. It's the state is the transformation from the null system to another system. Anyway, the problem is that I will not going to say you anything about this, because we don't want to divert our focus from the main topics. But please, ask Giulio. So now, we want to go on. We want to go on, and the point is, you know, we understood that quantum theory is a quantum information. It's information theory. What about if everything is done of quantum systems, and then the old physics would be an information theory, right? So, and what is the old physics? It's a quantum field. The set of quantum fields. So can we say that a quantum field is just a collection of infinitely many quantum systems that are unitarily interacting with a bunch of other quantum systems? This would be like to say that the quantum field, and so the whole universe in some sense, is a huge quantum computer. And actually, my friend Seth Lloyd would be very sympathetic with this idea, you know that. He wrote his book, Programming the Universe. It's a very popular book. And the point is that there are also other things that comes up. So we can try to answer to this question, which may be, this is not maybe, is the chicken or the egg? I don't know. I think it's not. Does the continuum play a fundamental role, or it's only a mathematical idealization? And also, can we say that space, time, and all physical observables are emergent features of this information processing? And actually, when I say that, I mean that, you know, we have to translate everything into informational terms. Like, we want to understand what is inertial mass in terms of information. We want to understand what is gravitation in terms of information. We want to understand what is energy, what is work, everything. This is actually a huge program, and let me say, this is in some sense the dream of John Archibald Wheeler, who prophesied years ago that physics is information. He says, it from bit. Everything is made of bits. Actually, we should say more properly that everything is made of qubits now, right? And which is the reverse of what Landauer was saying, is that every kind of information is supported by physical stuff. It's not that information is made of physical stuff, it's supported by physical stuff. But the idea is that the reversely, the stuff is made of information. And actually, you have really to try to imagine this huge paradigm shift. So there are no atoms. Atoms do not exist. Atoms are emergent features of a quantum information processing. You know, you recognize here the movie, The Matrix. So we are living in a huge simulation. And this informational paradigm is a huge change in ontology. So I know it's very hard to get it. And probably most of the people working in hidden variable would hate it. And that's, I know, because I can tell you that Sheldon Goldstein, 7 years ago, when I was just at the start of this program, very harshly, at the end of my talk, said, you know, explain in 2 minutes the double slit experiment. And you know who is Sheldon Goldstein, right? This very famous Bohmian guy. And I said, you know what? Explain me in 2 minutes. The double slit experiment. You know, it takes not so so short time for a bomb to get it, right? And actually, this figure is everywhere since half a century. no, the same figure about the double slit experiment. So this is what they are able to explain. But I don't want to dwell too much on that. But as an hypothesis, it's a very parsimonious hypothesis. That's the point. That's the power of this ontology. The Occam razor would recommend it, because what we are trying to do, we are trying to reduce everything to quantum theory. That's the point. With addition of some, you know, very logical, very simple, general principle that everybody would agree, which we will see also today. And I should also say that also, you know, our conventional ontology of space-time and matter is a little bit inconsistent with our theoretical way of describing nature. Think to the, you know, ontology of particle. What is a particle? Say, tell to my mother that a particle is not a particle, it's a particle and a wave at the same time. Which ontology is that? Or that space is nothingness and it has a metric. Right? Or if I want to, you know, ask to a physicist, what is reality? Reality is made of stuff, right? What is stuff? It's made of atoms. What are atoms? Particles. What are particles? According to field theory, they are states of a quantum field. Then ask to Chris, what are states? They are states of belief. So stuff is a state of belief. Okay, so this is the ontology. So please forget all the ontology and just look at the right way of satisfying with the minimum hypothesis the Occam razor. That's our purpose. And let's go to the physics. So this is the outline of the talk. I will definitely cancel the first part. And Giulio is here at your disposal. So the first thing we will see is how space-time and relativistic covariance emerge from the quantum computation. And actually, I will in part reduce something that I said here in February. And then we will see other, and say this is just for fun, way of getting something about spatial relativity without space and time. These are ideas from other authors that are unknown. I ask many people, they don't know these things. Then we will see that the Dirac equation can be just considered as a general information flow, can be derived as an information flow without the need of Lorentz covariance. And finally, actually, we will see that we can immediately recognize a meaning for the inertial mass and even for the Planck constant, and that there are indeed observable, in principle, observable consequences, maybe at the Planck scale, but that are observable in some experiment. And after the end of the talk, because I think there will be not much time, if there are people here that are working quantum gravity, since I don't know anything about that, I would ask them consulting, because I have three hypotheses of work, and I want to ask them what they think is the best, the most promising, or the one worth pursuing. So let's start from how relativity emerged from the computation. So you have to... Oh.
Can I just make a comment, maybe not to sidetrack the whole discussion, but all the ideas that you had on the information side, any notion of information that I know of, presupposes time, a background time in which these operations happen.
No, it's ordering, causal ordering.
Well, okay, but there's some background. Yeah, that's what I mean.
Okay, let me go on. Actually, there is no time.
So there's some linear ordering, right? Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, sure. There is always an ordering, but that's not space-time.
It's not space.
It's not space and not time.
But it's the same. But it is an equivalent thing to time. It's playing the same role.
Yeah,
so I don't think
everything is equivalent.
Mean, the ordering that we have in the when we really carry out operations is
right.
The temporal ordering.
You know, everything at the long run is equivalent. If it's good.
No, but I'm saying I think this is circular because you can't. You can't say you'll get out time.
Oh, it's too early to comment on that, because this comment can be done at the end. So we have to see everything and then you comment. You are commenting in advance. You know the
yes.
End of the story. They don't know. Okay, sorry. Let me continue. Then we discuss that.
Yeah, I said I didn't want to discuss, but I can't resist throwing that out.
Okay. So the point is that you have to consider that what is really primordial in the informationalism, in the informational description, are events, no? Like, you know, the facts of Wittgenstein. There are only events are not happening in space, but space is made of events. And our way of describing reality is that we make connection between events by we construct causal connection between events. So a theory is just a set of causal connection between events. So the quantum field theory is a set of causal connection between events. So actually, a causal network. The theory is a causal network. The quantum field theory, the theory is a causal network. One thing that I said last year, I'm just reviewing, actually, the way, the idea of using causal network is a very old idea that was suggested for the first time more than 20 years ago by Raphael and his student Bobelli, right?
Luca.
On the PRL, Johann, right?
Johann Lee.
Yeah, so he's very famous, he's very well known. And what I showed in this February, I showed that actually I made a visual proof of the Lorentz contraction of space and dilation of time. And actually, I'm very shortly reviewing now, because then I will give an analytical proof of the derivation of Lorentz transformations from this construction. So the idea is that in the quantum information processing, you have a maximum speed of information or flow of one gate per step. You cannot go faster than that, like two gates per step here, because otherwise you have to go against causality. You have to go from the output to the input, as you can see here. And if you want to go slower, then you need to change direction all the time. That's a very important point. This is actually the equivalent of the Zittenberg-Begu in Dirac. So this is a quantum computer. Here we have the gates. The gates are the events. The wires are the registers, the systems, the physical systems. And we have a notion of a causal connection between systems or also between events. In these kind of notions, we have a duality between system and events. We can say the same things for systems and for events. And we have a notion also of the reversely of systems or events that are causally independent, that they are not connected. And we say that a set of systems that are causally independent is a slice. This is the name that is used in the literature. And we can have a causal chain of events or a causal chain of systems, depending on the context, that is represents a line of universe. And actually, this is also a very generic observer in some sense. And then we can take a global slice, which is a set of systems or events that are causally independent. So, as you see here, everything is topology. There is no metric at all. And we have a notion of closeness. We can count the distance in terms of how many events and in a slice or in a causal chain. And then the metric will come in this way, by event counting. So now, we want to build a foliation. What does it mean? So the notion of synchronicity is up to you. You are the observer. You decide which systems or which events are synchronous. They must be independent. You take a set of independent, causal independent events, and you say, these are synchronous. And this actually is very concrete. If you think to a concrete situation, actually this is an idea of more than 30 years ago by Leslie Lamport, who is the creator of LaTeX, who says that, you know, if you take a parallel distributed calculus and you want to synchronize all the subroutine calls with a unique clock, then you need a foliation. It's something like that. I'm just very, very shortly, I'm saying this is a very long paper. It's a very interesting paper, a very long paper. But that's the idea. So it's a concrete situation. Now, so you are the observer, you decide that these systems, for example, these are causal independent, and you take them as slices. Now you say these systems are synchronous, these systems are synchronous, these systems are synchronous, and then you put the synchronous systems on the same line in such a way, so that you put the events, synchronous events on the same line, and in such a way that this axis become the time axis. So you say this happened at the same time, this happened at the same time, this happened at the same time. This circuit is topologically the same circuit as this one. And now, let's consider a line of light. This is at the maximum speed of one gate per step. With the light, we can build a clock, an Einstein clock, which is just a tick-tack of line of light bouncing between two mirrors. And now let's see what is the result when we stretch the circuit and we build up this foliation, and this is the end of what's happening to the tick-tack of the clock. If you count here, the distance between the tick and the tack, the beginning and the end of the tick-tack, is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8 events. If you count here now, they are 16, double. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 16. And if you count here, the distance between the two mirrors, because of the sparseness of events, here it becomes two events, and here is only one. So this is a space contraction and time dilation. Visually, that's not a proof, but it's anyway very interesting, because you can see that. And this is actually what you would do if you make a Minkowski representation, essentially, of the same process. And you see that the only difference here is a shear. Now, so can we start saying that we get space-time endowed with relativity from pure topology? We need something more if you really want to derive the Lorentz transformation. Oh, again, my friend would be very sympathetic. He says in this paper, which I think is a very interesting paper, even though it was never published, the geometry of space-time is a construct derived from the underlying quantum information processing. Actually, because if you define space-time in terms of measuring space-time, really, then it is like that. So it's very operational. Okay, now let's try to derive, really, the Lorentz transformation. This is a derivation that I did with my PhD student, second year, Alessandro Tosini. It's not the only derivation. It's not an optimal derivation. There may be better derivation. I don't know. There is still a lot to explore. But it's just a way to see how it comes. Lorentz transformation can come out. So the notion of light cone is very simple, because you just consider all possible events that are causally connected to one event at the output. And this would be the future light cone, and this would be the past light cone. Now, one crucial thing to derive the Lorentz transformation, you need more than causality. You need more than the causal network. Let me first say that it's convenient to represent the causal network in this conventional usual way instead of a quantum circuit, right? Just because of graphics. So this is the equivalence. But what you need more, you need the Galileo principle. So you need that the causal network is homogeneous. Actually, not only topological homogeneous, homogeneous dynamically, in the sense that all these wires, as we do in our joint paper with Giulio and Paolo, they have labels. They are different systems. They are different registers. This can be, you know, a qubit. This can be a qutrit. They can be different. So you want to have a tile such that if you translate this tile everywhere, you get the old circuit. So the circuit is homogeneous, means that this is the physical law, and the physical law holds everywhere, forever. So this is the way in which you describe reality. This is not reality. This is the way in which we describe reality. So the Galileo principle, and actually this is not the general Galileo principle, it's just, you know, uniformity of the law. Now, what is an observer? An observer is a universe line. And we put an origin of it. So this is zero time. And actually, this is a very general observer. If you work with general observer, you are in big trouble. And so, why does it work? Let's see. Technology. Now, is something wrong with my remote controller. The battery already died? How can it be? It's brand new. Okay, so I changed position. Now, no, there is something more. Everything is dead. Okay, there is something wrong here. Let's try to... Okay, so now, take two identical observers. But not any observer. You see, this is a tic-tac. This is a clock. It's a special kind of observer, periodic. This is another clock. Take two events, and then you say that the two events are synchronous if you send two signals of light from one observer to the other, and then you count the number of tic-tac, and you get the same number. This is actually what you do. And now that you have defined synchronicity, actually this can be done by formulas. You define a cardinality, which is sine, depending if you go causal-wise or anti-causal-wise. Then you take the infimum of the cardinality and blah, blah. So you can define this by equations. Now, the point that you have to realize that when you define synchronicity, if you take a very general observer, it may happen that there are not even two events that are synchronous for a general observer. If you take observers that are periodic, like this one, there are always infinitely many events that are synchronous. And so you can build up foliation, like here. But as you can see, there are events that are missing in the foliation. This happens. So this is a very general phenomenon. And actually, Raphael discovered this phenomenon of sparseness of events in a different context. I remember there's a very old paper about that. You have events when you make the Minkowski transformation, they become very sparse. This is a very similar phenomenon. Anyway, with a completely different interpretation. And now, what you have to do? You have to make a coarse graining of the events. So you take two events here together, and you make a joint gate. This is equivalent to a single gate. Means that you are also joining together the 2 qubit into a cube quadrant, if you want, and here you have still a qubit. So you have to make a coarse graining and to change everything. And actually, this is relevant because in a usual Lorentz transformation, in order to have symmetry between the two systems, you have to rescale the space. This is related to the rescaling of the space. Now, take an event. We want to define coordinates. We already have a foliation. We can define coordinates this way. Take an observer with an origin of it, and then translate the observer in such a way that the origin cover the event. This can be always done because the circuit is periodic, is dynamically homogeneous. And now send two signals from one observer to the other in this way. And now count all possible steps here and all steps here. Here you have 3 steps, here you have 12 steps. These are a pair of coordinates, 12 and 3. And you can see that using the foliation that you built up before, that if you take the difference between these two coordinates, this is the time of the sleeve of the foliation. And if you take the sum divided by 2, this is the position over the volume. So these are time and space. Actually, this is a very simple way of building up coordinates. So what you do now, you make a pi 4 rotation, right? And then you get time and space. And now, consider, actually, we are really selecting a very special kind of observers that are clocks, periodic. And now we have frames that we say they are in standard configuration that corresponds to boost. Actually, all of that corresponds to boost. What are boosts? Are just uniform foliations. And then you see here we have these numbers, alpha 1 and alpha 2 and beta 1, beta 2 and so on. Alpha is the number of steps on the right of the tic-tac. Beta is the number of steps on the left. And alpha 1, 2 is the ratio between the number of steps of the second observer and the number of steps of the first observer. So it's 4 divided by 1 here. And for example, in this case, it would be 12 divided by 4. So this would be 3 and so on. Right? Now, the velocity can be very easily calculated in terms of number of steps. The number of steps on the right minus the number of steps on the left, you divide by the total number of steps, and you get the velocity. And from now, the calculations are so easy that even an elementary school student can do it. You substitute here the velocities when you compose two transformations. So you have, this is the velocity of observer 3 respect to observer 1 in terms of the velocity of observer 2 in terms of observer 1 and observer 3 in terms of observer 2. You substitute here and you get the composition of the Lorentz transformation. But that's really very little, because we can get more. By very simple calculation of this kind, you get the Lorentz transformations. And written in this way, you have this constant. There is a simplification from this and this one. The speed of light here is 1, remember. And if you want to get rid of this constant, then you get the coordinates are not integer anymore. But then you get the usual Lorentz transformation. There is this rescaling. And otherwise, you can take in this way. Why not? They are integer, even better. And this rescaling depends on the observer, because alpha 1, 2 and beta 1, 2 are observer dependent. So you can put them in the definition of coordinates. And then you get the usual Lorentz transformation.
Can we go back a couple of...
Yeah?
So one thing I didn't understand, observer 3,
yeah,
for example, looks to be objectively different from observer 1.
Yeah, there is a mistake on...
Oh, no, I'm not looking at that. Just
which
the
one?
Diagram. Just look at the blue, the
yeah.
Cyan.
Yeah, the blue is 1, 1, 1, 1. This one is 4, 2, 4, 2, 4, 2.
Right.
And this one is 12, 2, 12.
Right, so the 12, 2, 12, 2 somehow is not... There's no automorphism of that diagram that'll turn observer 1 into observer 2.
You can't come back. There is privileged... The most dense foliation is there. I believe that the empty space is meaningless. So
is that
that's a big difference. No, but that's a big difference with relativity. The Einstein.
Yes.
So you know there is the Mach principle. There are many other things. You know, we can discuss that later. This is a big point.
Okay.
So there is an observer that has the maximum number of events.
Yes, that's what.
But this is good.
This is good.
Yeah. Because I don't believe in the Einstein relativity as it is.
So it's just an effective thing, but the more fundamental...
I think it's a fundamental thing.
Fundamentally we'll lose
it's something very fundamental, which I think is very important. It's the real fabric of space. Yeah?
How does the dimensionality of space then come
from? Okay, here... that's another problem. So here everything is one dimension. If you want to go to more than one dimension, it depends on the topology of the network. If you are able to embed the topology of the network without making, you know, superposition of wires into two dimensions, then it's two dimensions. In three dimensions, it's three dimensions. It's all. Okay. You can have as many dimensions as you want.
This is going to harken back to Raphael's earlier comment, but in some sense, you've assumed this rather specialized structure. It's homogeneous, it's translation variant, it's got all this stuff on it. So in some sense...
I will comment more about that.
Isn't this... Well, I'm just saying, it looks like it's building this in at the get-go.
Right. Yeah. But we need to...
All right.
We need to to see also this point. So this is a taboo in physics. Conventionality, you know? Physics is real. We describe reality. The world is symmetric. Right? So God made the world symmetric. Indeed, the causal network very well represents the conventionality of synchronization of clocks, of homogeneity of time, and homogeneity of space. Because, this is a very long debate, it started at the beginning of the 60s, was Reichenbach, the philosopher of Vienna Circle, who said that you can never, never measure the speed of light between two different points, because you need to synchronize clock. But in order to synchronize two clocks, you need to know the speed of light between two different points. Because otherwise, you can just measure the speed of light on a closed loop with one clock. So there is a circular argument. And actually, you build up a whole kind of, you know, Lorentz transformation with this asymmetry in the speed of light going far and coming back, things like that. And also space. How can I check that space is homogeneous? Here, this is the length of my meter. Here, there's another meter. If I move this meter from here to here, it becomes smaller, and then they look the same. What does it mean? It's just conventional. So, conservation of momentum is conventional. Conservation of energy is conventional. So, I'm breaking a big taboo, I know, but it is actually the case. Whereas the physical law, stripped of all conventionality, is the causal network, which is topologically homogeneous. And I know that you agree with me.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. I think you should add a picture of Poincaré.
Yes,
oh, yeah, oh, there are many. I'm sorry, there are so many, especially
this last comment about the fact that, you know, absolute size doesn't have a meaning in different points.
Yeah, yeah, no, but there is Bersan, even Bersan and many others.
There was a famous controversy between Poincaré and Whitehead at this point.
Poincaré, at least, is a very famous and established mathematician, but there are philosophers that have nothing to do with mathematics and physics. You know, everybody was discussing this. And, by the way, it seems in the 77 that Mallarmé was proving that all this discussion was a fake. No? It has a very strong theorem, but unfortunately the theorem was based on the reality of the time reversal. So if you want to be really a pragmatist, time reversal is a nonsense, and the whole problem is still open. But if you believe in causal, causal nets like Raphael, then everything is clear.
I can't disagree with that. But I think David did prove. I think his theorem was based only on the space-like relationship. So the question was whether there's an objective notion of synchronization given the causal structure of Minkowski space.
No, the problem
and
is
he
that
just took, I don't think he assumed time reversal in this.
No. This is a very, very famous point. And there is an entire thesis that I have. If you want, I can give it to you. And the point is that this time reversal is actually the problem, that he assumes symmetry under time reversal. This is an assumption in the proof which breaks everything.
Well, I mean, Minkowski space, the geometry of Minkowski space is symmetric under time reversal.
Yeah, but
I think, well, we can discuss later.
Yeah, but if you don't want to assume it, I'm saying the geometry of Minkowski space is homogeneous and there is no problem with it.
Yes.
It's conventionally homogeneous, conventionally, everything is conventional. There's nothing bad in understanding that we are living with convention. It's very realistic. It's very scientific.
No, the issue is whether he assumed something that he shouldn't, that is not justified, and I don't think he did.
But this is a very famous point. I know for sure. If you want,
okay,
later I can give you the reference here.
Okay.
Because I have it here.
Okay.
So now, just for fun, for the disbelievers, those who really think that there is space, that null exists. For those who really believe that relativity cannot be derived without space, I give you another three ways, which are unknown. First is from this guy, Irvenstein, from SLAC. I don't know which position he has there. I couldn't find him on the web. Anyway, he wrote this interesting, strange book, The Concept of Object as the Foundation of Physics. And here, he explained this way of obtaining the composition of velocities in special relativity by just a random walk in one dimension. Random walk, you can go only right or left. You cannot go straight because there is no straight, it's only one dimension, and you cannot stop, that's the point, you cannot stop, you have to go. So, the walk is described by a string of bits, plus, minus, right or left. Now, the fraction of steps on the right is 3/4 here, and the fraction of step on the left is 1/4 here. You take the difference, and this is the average velocity. And this is 1/2. So you make 4 space step into 8 time steps. That's the average velocity. Now, take another instance of the same kind of random walk, right? And this is the average velocity. P minus Q is 3/4. Now, if you sum the two velocities, you get 5/4, which is forbidden, because here you cannot go faster than one step per time step. You cannot go faster than that. You cannot go faster than that. What is the point? Is that when here you go on the left and here you go on the right, you compose the two motion, and what happens? You have to go. You cannot stop. So the only thing you can do, you can miss an event. You can cancel this event. This event does not exist. Now, here there is no event. Now you compose the velocity in this way. Now, you consider the fraction of events that are both on the left for both motion and both on the right for both motions, and you don't take into account the PQ events on the left and on the right. You take these two fractions, and then you build up the difference of the two, which is the average velocity, and what you get? You get the composition of parallel speeds of special relativity. But there is no surprise. This random motion, as you can see, this random walk is exactly the random walk on the quantum circuit that I gave before. So it's the same thing. Now there is another proof, which is even more interesting. I'm saying very strange. This is from this guy, Kevin Brown. This guy really wants to remain anonymous because there is a huge website who was done by him with a lot of mathematical physics. Very interesting lectures, knows a lot. Is it mine? I really did explore it, so I cannot tell if everything is good or right, but because it's huge. What I discovered is that this guy didn't exist. And then I look on the website, I'm saying, who is this guy? I found a blog. Where they say, oh, this guy actually exists. He put his signature in one page of the website. To the extent that the website was completely cloned by another person who pretended to. We didn't know that the name was hidden inside. Something really hot. So it plagiarized. It was completely plagiarized. Anyway, the idea is the following. Is that, we measured velocity divided by c is equal to 1 here. The maximum is one gate per step, right? So v squared is the probability between 0 and 1. So we can take the velocity as an event and the v squared as the probability of the event. Right? Okay. Stupid idea. Orthogonal velocities are independent. Well, why not? Now, take the probability of the union of two events, which is the sum of the probability minus the probability of the intersection. And then you have the sum of the probability minus the product of the probabilities, because they are independent, right? Substitute the velocity, and you get the formula of composition of orthogonal speeds in special relativity. That's real. Really strange. Actually, if you take the events disjoint, then you get Galileo. I know, that's fun, right? I want to tell these things to you because it's fun. Now, if you rewrite this identity in this way, this is the De Morgan identity. The negation of the union is the intersection of the negation. I don't know, it's... Think about. I leave this to you as a candy after lunch candy. And then there is another. This is Stephen Wolfram. I don't know. Everybody knows who is Stephen Wolfram. He's the CEO of the Mathematica. He wrote this huge book, 1,500 pages. They fill up all the shelves in Barnes and Noble and more than years ago. I didn't buy it. It was too expensive and, very bulky. You need a luggage for it. And I didn't understand anything about that. But there was a page in which he was saying, I found this on the web because I don't hold the book. And a page in which he says that we can derive the relativity from just cellular automata. I didn't understand a single word. And actually, I'm not the only one. Because, for example, Scott Aronson reviewed the book, and he doesn't say that it's understandable. Actually, it seems that nobody understood. But there is a talk by this guy, Kafur, who is working in the same Mathematica Corporation. And these figures come from this talk. And you can see that this cellular automata resembles very well the drawing that I gave you at the beginning. And these are the foliations. So the idea cannot be wrong. Say they are approximate. I'm not saying that because of me. Anyway, that's very interesting. Now, let's see what is the information and meaning of inertial mass in this context and how the quantum field emerges. So, information can flow only in two directions. So we stick on one dimension. Many of these things, actually, almost everything can be generalized to more than one dimension. But then everything becomes very ugly. I cannot, you know, make drawing in more than one dimension. So information can flow only in two directions. This direction, this direction. Let's describe the flows by two fields, phi plus and phi minus. This means that it's going to the right. This means that it's going to the left with velocity v. Okay, velocity v should be 1 in informational term, but if you want to measure the velocity in the usual way, would be the time, which is the chronon, minimum chronon, and the distance here between two events. Let's say this is the Planck distance, the Planck length. And now, we want to change the speed. The only way to have an average speed, which is constant, is to have an exactly periodic motion. And how can you get the periodic motion here? This is first year physics lab student stuff. You put a coupling which is imaginary. You know, it's periodic, right? Looks pretty stupid, right? But this is exactly the Dirac equation without the spin. And without the effort of Dirac. So you remember the way in which the Dirac equation is derived. You have to force relativity. It's not easy. But here, relativity is automatic. Because here, we have homogeneity. Oh, these derivatives are finite difference derivatives, and they are generally coarse-grained, both the time and the space derivative.
What are those variables, phi plus and phi minus?
Sorry?
What are the phi plus and phi minus?
These are any kind of field you want in your fantasy describing the information flow. In quantum information, this will be a quantum field. So it's a quantum operator. It's an operator. But this function for every kind of information can be, you know, quaternion information, can be any information you want. So any field.
What's the domain of the function?
Who cares? I'm talking about matter of principle. I'm not talking about mathematics here. Domain, what does it mean? Depends on the information, the kind of information. Could be classical information.
I don't know how this function relates to the picture.
So, okay, I will give you now what is this function in the quantum case. And that actually also in the classical case is very easy to say.
Sorry, what?
But this is a more general concept. What I want to say is this is a more general concept. Sorry?
Why do you say it's without spin? I thought without spin, components are the spin.
No. This is a particle, and the particle, everything spinless, because when you have the spin, then this matrix has dimension 4. And you have the gamma matrices.
Oh, are we in 1 plus 1 dimension?
Yeah, this is
3 plus 1 dimension.
This is a 2-dimensional vector, yep. And we are in 1 plus 1 dimension.
One time one space
and 2-dimensional.
Right, so, but in 1 plus 1 dimension, the Dirac spinners only have 2 dimensions. You don't need 4 dimensions.
Oh!
So this is the Dirac.
Right.
This is the Dirac spinner.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Great, yes. But what I'm saying is, that, yeah, if you want to put the spin here, it becomes redundant. Yeah.
Yeah,
you're right. Right. Thank you. Now, let's see what's going on. So, we put an I in front, This is the Dirac equation. Now, what is the coupling in terms of the usual Dirac equation? It's speed of light multiplied by the inverse Compton wavelength. Now, we substitute the usual expression for the inverse Compton wavelength, and what we get? We get that this is actually the relation between the mass in kilogram and the mass omega, the informational mass, the coupling, the fact that there is this coupling between left and right, making the flow slower. This is the inertial mass. So, is what? Is the h bar is just the relation between the mass in kilogram, the conversion factor between the mass in kilogram and the mass in second to the minus one. And actually, you see, if I multiply by c squared, I have what? H bar omega equal to mc squared, namely the rest energy equal to the Planck quantum, right? Which is just an interpretation, can be interpreted as the conversion between the information notion of mass and the usual notion of mass. I think it's interesting. Anyway, let's go on. In February, when I presented my talk about these ideas at the beginning, I was at the very beginning, and I did a huge mistake. I confess, I did a mistake. It's not published on a journal, but it's published on a proceeding. I consider the simulation of quantum field theory made of infinitesimal transformation. Infinitesimally close to the identity. This is a big mistake, because I wanted to derive relativity from the network. But then the maximal speed must be c. One gate per step must be c. But if I make infinitesimally close to the identity transformation, that the average speed at the end will be c, but the maximal speed, in order, you know, to have an average speed which is finite with infinitesimal transformation, it must be infinite. This was a mistake. I really, you know, I'm very embarrassed about that. It took me time to understand.
But did anybody in the audience catch you?
No.
They should be ashamed.
No. It's always the fault of the audience. But anyway, it took me, you know, some time to understand. It was a real mistake. And I don't tell you the infamous way I discovered it. I can tell you in private. But, so now, if we want just to see that we have information flow going at the speed of light on the left or the right, these transformations are swaps. Swaps are very far from the identity. Now, let's see. Now we enter a little bit of more detail in quantum field theory. We want a linear flow of information, because we want the Dirac equation. Linear flow means what? The unit transformation must be a linear combination of field operators, namely a matrix. By composition, we see this matrix must be unitary. And that automatically will preserve the, if we want to have then, commutation or anti-commutation relations. So this will be the evolution in terms of the big matrix, which will describe your gate. Now, there is no infinitesimal transformation. Forget everything. Everything is wrong. There is no Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian makes no sense. There are unitary, discrete unitary. So, how can I live without an Hamiltonian? I can define the equivalent of an Hamiltonian, which is a local one. Let me call this a gate Hamiltonian. This actually was an idea of Tosini. You know, in order just the matrix which give you the derivative with respect to time, the right one, the right derivative, the right time derivative. And that is what? That's trivial. It's just the difference between a forward unitary and a backward unitary. And you see, the backward and the forward can be different, so it's not emission. Oh, that's a problem. What we can do? We take two steps forward and two steps backward, and then it becomes emission. Depends on the periodicity of the circuit. So if the circuit is periodic every two lines, then we need to make a coarse graining with this k equal to two steps forward and two steps backward. Now, the point is that we need to develop a calculus, because, you know, calculation immediately explodes. You know, field theory is a mess. That's why people don't study field theory seriously, apart from the one that, because it's a lot of calculation. And you need to be smart. And, you know, Feynman was a smart guy. So we're about to do the same. We make a path sum calculus. We want to know when we evolve a field, the field at this time is made as a linear combination of all the fields operators at this time. We want to know the coefficients of the expansion, for example, in front of this field operator. What we do? This operator must be in the causal past. Then we consider all possible paths. And then on each path, what we do? We say, this is Y1, this is Y2, this is Y1, this is Y2 for the gates. Then we multiply all matrix elements in this path. So this would be U from 2 to 1, this would be U from 2 to 2 of the second matrix, this would be U from 1 to 2, and so on. In this way, we sum over all possible paths, we get a coefficient of this expansion. This is extremely helpful. You know, before doing that, I made a lot of mess. You know, I'm not so young, so I do mistakes in calculation, and it's very easy. Now you can do calculation just now, in this moment. You see here, this is the Hamiltonian, two steps forward, two steps backward. This is what? This comes from A to 1, B to 1. You see, we are going from 5 plus 0 to 5 plus minus 1. So there is a delta minus shift. And this will come from the backward term, from here to here. You see, B 1-2 daga, A 1-2 daga, and so on. We build up the full Hamiltonian in this way, and we can check his emission. It's a simple check, but still, you know, that's the check. And this is because the circuit is periodic, because there is a line of A and line of B, line of A, a line of B. And now, I want to show you the observable effect that we have. So, this is the Hamiltonian. Let's write in the Dirac form, taking into consideration the possibility that there is a renormalization of the speed. This is actually what is going to be the effect. We know that omega is c times lambda to the minus 1. Here, we substitute all the matrix elements by what comes from here. And what we get, okay, we have to, you know, take into account unitarity, take and simplify things like, you know, there is an overall phase every line that's not relevant. And so we can take SU2 instead of U2. And we have matrix A and matrix B here. Now we write in terms of theta, and phi in terms of these angles, in terms of zeta and lambda to the minus 1 and c, and what we find is this one. So the sine of theta is zeta, so zeta is smaller than 1, so there is a reduction of the speed of light, and is done in this way. This is a ratio between two masses, because this is actually the inverse, lambda is the inverse of the mass of the electron, or whatever is the particle described by the quantum field. Now, we can take this, actually, as the ratio between two mass, and if we consider that 2a is the Planck length, so there will be 2 qubits every Planck length, this will be the ratio between the mass and the Planck mass. So you have a kind, you know, of refraction index, which goes to infinite at the Planck mass. So the Planck mass, everything stops. The information doesn't flow. I think this phenomenon should be known in physics. I'm sure that some expert of quantum field theory knows. Anyway, it's something which is in principle observable. There is a renormalization of the speed c in the equation, which depends on the mass. Now, it can be proved that it is independent on the circuit topology, as long as you describe this equation. And I don't give you details, but there is a very elegant way, because at the end you take the norm of the Hamiltonian gate, and you have this bound. And from this bound, you take this bound, you obtain this bound, which is the same, as you see. So the refraction index must be larger than this value, cannot be 1. If the mass is different from 0, the refraction index cannot be 1.
Is this related to this, what is it called, Lieb-Robinson?
No.
It's not the same thing.
I think it's very different.
Can I
finish? No, because I have a few minutes. Yes. Otherwise, yes. You are missing other things. Then we discuss. Okay.
Okay.
I would like to say many other things. So, what is interesting is that now we want to write explicitly in terms of operator, field operators, A and B, and we can do this both if we consider Fermi operator or Bose operator, and this is actually the usual Schwinger Jordan representation of SU2, actually. It's very common. This gives, in terms of the evolution of the field, exactly this matrix. And now, interesting, consider the case in which the field is bosonic, then you can just realize as a boson, you know, harmonic oscillator operator, or is fermionic, then you can realize as a Clifford algebra construction. There is a string of sigma z here, which finished with a sigma minus only, and on the odd and or the, on the even position for the phi plus and on the odd position for phi minus. And then you substitute here, and since they are exactly this one close to this one, all the sigma cancel here, and also this one close to this one, all the sigma cancel, and what you get A and B in terms only of Pauli matrices, which means give up completely the field, forget it, there is only quantum information there without the field. The whole dynamics can be done without the field. I think this is very interesting. So the gates affect only the local algebra. But if you want to describe with field, you can. Now, you can come back to the old theory. You need an Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian must be a global Hamiltonian. This is related to an infinitesimal transformation of the usual theory. And what is useful for? You take the commutator with the field, and you get the time derivative, which is the gate Hamiltonian. So the global Hamiltonian should be written in terms of the gate Hamiltonian in this way. So we have a connection with the old theory through the gate Hamiltonian and the global Hamiltonian. And we can even establish when the quantum field theory is simulable by a quantum computer. It must satisfy this bound. And by the way, this bound, we know that all quantum field theory that we know are simulable. They satisfy this bound. The only thing is that this bound contains this renormalization of the speed of light. You have to take into account this. This comes from this bounding.
Isn't there a problem that for different fields you'll have a different speed of light? Different light cones for different.
So if you
different
if you,
part of, you know.
So if you take A divided by tau universal as the speed of light, then you have a normalization which depends on the feature of the field. Mm-hmm. Not only on the mass, it depends if the field is more complicated.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. Sure. Which is interesting. This is a very small effect. Can be seen at maybe the Planck scale. Depends on how much is A and how much is tau. Actually, how much is A, because A divided by tau is C. So we just need to know if A is the Planck length, then we actually it's 2A is the Planck length. So it's 2 bits for Planck length, not 1. Anyway, we can build up a first quantization. I'm almost done. And you know, we need to just consider a vacuum. The vacuum must be invariant under the information processing. We have a constant of motion, which is the number of particles. It's very easy. I'm saying this is trivial. And then I can build up a momentum operator and a position operator, and I can recover back the quantization, the commutation relation. So in some sense, we are doing quantum theory without quantization rule. We want to get rid of quantization rule because the notion of particle is not a good one. And we can recover it from the notion of a single, of what I call PPM information encoding. What is PPM information encoding? One pulse But the position of the pulse gives a lot of information. 1 qubit up, the position of the qubit is a lot, is a huge information. Pulse position modulation, PPM, is the usual. So the idea is that now everything is, should be emergent, and we come back to the usual Schrödinger equation. In the first quantization, we have a huge reduction from the tensor product to the direct sum of dimension, and this is actually what the Bohm theory can simulate, cannot simulate the second quantization one. And actually, okay, let's see. I just want to be very fast because it's time to finish. And in more, there is something I want to tell. In more than one dimension, we need to increase the number of field operators. We have the problem that I still don't know if we can build up anti-commuting fields, but the point is that do we really need fields? Maybe we don't. We can work without. We can just work with quantum information. We want to do other things, like, for example, this coarse graining, you know, we join together systems. This should give the covariance, Lorentz covariance of the field, the unitary representation of the Lorentz group over the field. This is what should come from this coarse graining. This is not done yet. So it's just an idea. So, let's say. We can say that if we can consider, this is a theory, could be, we can regard this as a true theory at the Planck scale and then say that the usual quantum field theory is an approximation at a mesoscopic scale. Then many things are very nice, you know. And we have gauge invariance. I told this last year because of the choice of basis of each Hilbert space of each wire is up to you. So you have a unitary operator defined on a slice as a function of the position. And so you have a non-abelian gauge theory. So you have many other things. So these are the conclusions. And let me say that there are... So the conclusion I'm saying, I don't need to stress them more. There are many things to do. These are the very urgent one. We want to build up a general correspondence between Lagrangian and Gates. This is done, essentially. And we want to see quantization rule as emergent. We know how to do it, but we need an interpretation. We want to build up a complete quantum information for three dimension in Dirac. This is the work of the thesis of Alessandro Tosini. Emergent unit representation of the Lorentz group is in progress. Do we need fields? Oh, that's something very interesting. Informational meaning of energy, gravitational mass, violation of Lorentz covariance, and experimental consequence. That's the most interesting part. Are there any other features that can be seen in principle in experiment or at a cosmological level? I don't know. So this is the end of my talk. Thank you very much. And then I'm saying, I just want to mention that for the gravity people, I have a consulting after that.
I suggested that since we are a little bit behind schedule, we continue the discussion
informally, so who wants to ask a question can ask, but if you have commitments, feel free, please do. So we continue an informal discussion if there are questions.
Okay, anyway, I'm here for questions.
So, Mauro.
Si.
You, at some point, it was very, very fast. Can you go a few slides back where you start putting these field operators and then at some point everything becomes polymatrices? I'd like to understand the slide better.
Let's see. I think...
So while you're on this, I mean, it's related. You talk about Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
But you also have a unitary operator that takes you from one moment of time to the next, one clock, right?
Yeah.
Something. Is what's the is one just is u just e to the minus I h tau, or what's the relation?
Yes.
Why do you call one Hamiltonian and one?
Right, you are right. So
it's the transfer matrix.
Is it a transfer matrix? U is the
so
transfer matrix.
So this is the transfer matrix. This is the transfer matrix.
Actually, it's the law.
This is the slide.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I understand. So phi and what?
So this phi plus and phi minus
mm-hmm.
are the fields that are associated to these wires
uh-huh.
and these wires. So you have, you see B, phi plus, phi minus, then there is another B, phi plus, phi minus. And then there is A, and you have phi minus, phi plus, N plus 1,
right,
and so on.
These phis take values in 0, 1 only.
This is an operator.
Phis are operator.
In quantum information is an operator.
No, I understand, but they have only 12 eigenvalues, right?
They are only, they are not diagonalizable. They are,
I see that it's a
you see
the polymetrics.
No, they are not diagonalizable because they are either boson creation or annihilation actually operators, or they are sigma minus times a long string of sigma z. So they are not diagonalizable.
Okay, yeah. They are made already of just polymatrices.
No, this is actually this is a way to connect fields to local algebras. But the point is that you are not assured that you can get rid of fields because the bead is this. When you substitute the local algebra, the local algebras here, you may find out that this unitary operator involve also other algebras far apart. That's the problem. Because the field operator generally is non-local. In order to have anti-commutation and different position, cannot be a local algebra.
This is a Jordan Wigner's thing.
This is, this is Jordan Wigner. This is Jordan Wigner, not this one. From here to here, you need Clifford, there's something more.
Yeah, I'm just saying that string is...
No, wait a minute. The Jordan Wigner is this one. Sorry. Oh my God. So that
is
the previous one. This is the Jordan Wigner. This one. So that you have that the linear matrix relating the field is related to the unitary operator in terms of the field. This is the Jordan Wigner. That's another thing. You need more. You need to construct the field in terms of qubits. That's another thing. Which in this case I can do by the Clifford construction. This is not assured to be impossible in two dimensions for sure, and maybe in three, I don't know. Because this is true in one dimension. This is the weak, this is the only thing that is hard to generalize to more than one dimension. But the point is that, do we need fields? Here I'm connecting the usual field description with this one. What about to put this sigma everywhere, in any dimension?
Are these infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces? You have this A, this annihilation.
In the boson case, it's infinite dimensional. That's another interesting thing. Because you have the conservation of the number of photons, right? What about to keep this number bounded and to work with boson instead of fermions? And maybe make supersymmetry. I don't know. I'm just kidding. I'm just playing a game.
Are these? I thought they were bosons. You're saying that they?
No. Actually, it depends. You can make both choices.
You have a choice. But
yeah,
the bosonic case.
You get the same identity. You can use boson, or you can use bosons. These are annihilation operators, or fermions. It's the same.
What you're really saying here. You had the slide that just, you're saying that the fields undergo some linear transformation.
Yeah.
In each step, some local,
right.
Quasi-local or whatever.
Local, linear.
Local in the sense of a nearest neighbor.
Right.
Linear transformation from one step
right.
to the next.
And then I realized this in terms of field operators. And then I realized field operators in terms of local algebra. The field operators are non-local.
Why do you say that?
Because they anti-commute in different positions. If they are local, they commute.
Well, so the bosonic ones do commute, right?
Yeah, but the fermions
not. But the fermions do not. But, well, normally people regard that as local. Okay, it's a question of terminology.
Yeah, it's a question of terminology. But anyway, when I say no local, I say they don't commute.
They don't commute.
This is, you know, terminology, but everybody agrees, don't commute.
But squares, I mean, kind of bilinear,
oh, sure,
will commute.
They commute, yeah. So the point actually is that we don't need fields because they don't describe anything. They are just a device. We don't measure fields. We don't measure grass, we don't measure fermion field.
No.
And we just have observables, and we need to check covariance of observables, not of fields. But it's easy to check covariance of fields instead of observables. So the fields are an easy, are a simple thing, are a simplification, are a way of making things easier.
So in the fermionic case, what do you have? You had in the bosonic case, you had an infinite dimensional
right.
Hilbert space on every wire here.
Right, there is an infinite dimensional
in
space every wire.
In the fermionic case, it's just...
At the end, we discover we can use it just a two-dimensional. But we need this, because we didn't know. It could be infinite dimensional also here, if we are not able to realize the field with local algebra such that the operators are then function only of the local algebra. That's the point. We are not assured of this. This is a major point that must be proved in dimension 3.
But in 1 plus 1 here?
Here it's only 1 plus 1. Mm-hmm. 1 plus 3. Or we have to give up completely the notion of field and get the same physics. That's another option.
But then how would you do that?
Okay.
And what was the question?
Good question. But I think there is a way. I'm saying, why not? I have some hopes.
Okay, so I'd like to go to this notion of space-time geometry and progress towards your questions around gravity and
So you want to see the questions about gravity?
Well, sure, but I'd like to make some comment here, which is really that all that you've presented here actually doesn't need space.
Right.
If it's just information, I don't have space, I've just got information. And if I think of quantum theory is global. So the information is global. It's not localized anywhere in space. So somehow when I actually create geometry, real geometry, so that I can identify things separated, yes, we have information about these, but somehow that geometry is it's the emergent structure, which is what we recognize as the classical world. So what I see here is the quantum world, if you want, but you haven't yet got that emergent structure which gives rise to the real geometry. I'm not saying they're not connected. I think they are.
So the point is that you have events, and you connect events by causal connections. But the events are single points.
Well, why would it be a point? An event is...
Could be anything.
We get new information in the universe.
Right. You're right. But these special events, when I want to make quantum field theory, are very special events such that I can describe every event by coarse-graining these events. So they are elementary events,
so
not any event.
But as soon as you've done coarse-graining, you're assuming an underlying geometry.
No, I assume an underlying topology to make coarse-graining. I can coarse-grain the one that are causally connected.
Okay. This brings us to the quantum. You said you wanted to say something about quantum gravity. This sort of brings us to that.
I have a question.
Because in that case, you can't assume a fixed circuit. Right?
Actually, this is a very interesting for me now. I'm saying I'm asking you a question, and I really hope that you can give me a good advice in order not to waste my time. So, I have in mind, I'm very naive, you know, you are the guys that knows I still have, didn't enter the temple of quantum gravity. But I'm saying, no, my problem is the following. I see three possibilities. One, first possibility, is that we believe in information in such a way that there is a strong equivalence principle, in the sense that gravitational mass, information is equivalent to inertial mass, means that gravity must be a quantum effect. Which I thought it was a very stupid idea. Then I told this to Seth Lloyd. Said, oh, you always quote my paper, but you didn't read it. In my paper, I essentially say the same thing. And actually, this is the Sakharov-induced gravity. So this idea actually is very old, and actually was able to get, he say, something like the Einstein equation. I read the paper, I couldn't understand a single word, but anyway, first point. Second possibility, oh, okay, this means what? Which way I get it? Suppose that there are, you know, two qubits up, then I evolve two particles by the usual Schrödinger two-particle equation that I get by, you know, in first quantization, and then what I have? I have that sometime, you know, this structure become closed, they enter the same gate, and that time there is, you know, a kind of, you know, change. So after times, the time of the light, actually here it looks half of the time, but suppose this is not sufficient, you have to go more. In average, you need the time of the light, and then they start to interact. So there is, you know, these gates in between produce the gravity. I don't know. I was just, this is just a speculation. Just to second possibility, this is the one that I gave last year. The mass is, you know, is printed into the shape of the gate. So it's made with the event. Second possibility. Third possibility is the very complicated one, in which the circuit is not fixed, but you have the causal connection that can be they are dynamical, and this means that I call this a third quantization, because first quantization, particle is a system, then it becomes a state, right? And then means that we are quantizing the field, which is classical, is the wave function, it becomes an operator. Now we are quantizing the systems, means that there is a state saying which are the causal relation, which means that we need to increase exponentially the dimension of the Hilbert space. It's tensor exponential dimension of the Hilbert space. So it's extremely sophisticated theory. If it does exist, if it can be worked out mathematically, I don't know. Anyway, these are the three possibilities. Which one is the good one?
Well, okay, so let me address this one first.
We start from the first?
To this one.
This one?
I think this addresses, you know, the very first question, which is time built in from the outset? Because if you take this one, then what you're basically saying is, well, time is something that's independent. It's causing, you know, there are steps occurring in time that cause things to progressively connect together.
Ha. Huh.
Relativity theory is like the distinction between a block universe and a universe that's got some initial data and it's evolving, and it's not, the whole universe isn't laid out yet. And the block universe is kind of inconsistent with our notion of basic notions of quantum theory.
Yeah.
But, you know, and so in this case, you're saying, okay, so if it's not all laid out from the outset, then that means there must be some external time that's ticking away, which, you know, that gives rise to connections being made, which results in the eventual topology that you end up with. But then there's the question of, okay, so what do we mean by that time?
Yeah, is the time of the third quantization. It's still a causal relation on a higher level, I think. It's a completely different kind of... So you believe this is the way?
Well, no. I mean, actually,
I'd like to talk to you afterwards about some totally different ideas that I don't want to mix in
okay.
with this. But
So can I say answer to the first question that you did?
Okay.
So in what I say, time exists in the sense that there is a causal connection fixed. In this sense, is this what you were saying?
Yes.
But that's not time. This causal connection pre-established. But the point is that...
That's okay, but I mean...
I should be more philosopher here to say that causal connections are only in our mind. Because you proved... No, no. You've proved that causality is unprovable. And actually, Chris says probabilities cannot be measured. And the only way to define causality is through probability. So... And then I'm saying this is the way which we describe the things. There is not a reality that we discover.
Yeah, I mean, we can have a whole philosophical.
Yeah, but this is crucial because
which we should.
But you don't have a scientific argument to prove that the situation is this.
Well, I don't understand one and two. So can you explain what one and two were?
The previous. I'm saying if the Sakharov.
Sakharov, that takes for grip, as I know it,
if the Sakharov
call induced gravity, it takes for granted the existence of a space time metric,
Yeah, but it's usually field theory on flat.
No, it's not.
It's gravity comes from field theory. It cannot be. It must be flat.
No, so all he's talking about is the Einstein-Hilbert term in the action. So he's writing down a quantum field theory in curved space-time, but without any scalar, without any term there for the action, for the metric field, the terms that are for the quantum field, and the claim is that if you want to call it radiative effects, will induce the gravitational term. If you like, from the renormalization group, that's all that. So that's all that's being claimed. But the idea of a dynamical space-time, of a variable space-time metric, is already built in from the very beginning. It's not derived.
Yeah, but then
it's
we have
getting a, out gravity.
But
in that
we have another problem. So we have a dynamics which is
not
described.
Flat space
but, then we have the problem that we have a dynamics which is not described by quantum mechanics, by quantum theory. That's is not a problem for you.
Why is it?
So there is really something that we can observe that is not quantum somewhere. I never seen it.
There's an underlying space-time, but the geometry is not yet determined. The geometry evolves based on the evolution of the quantum fields.
Yes, and he's quantizing even the space-time geometry. So he's imagined putting it into a path integral in which you sum over different four geometries as well. So I think philosophically it doesn't differ. The only issue there is what's the status of that one particular term. Is it a purely effective term that's generated from the other ones, or is it put in as a fundamental term in the answer?
But can we really say that we have experimental proof that we need to give up pre-established causal ordering as an experimental proof, not just as a theory? So can we be sure that we really need to have dynamical causal connections.
Was the black hole an example?
Yeah, but the black hole is not an experiment. I'm talking about experiments.
Oh,
please.
We see black
we don't want to make propaganda.
Well, let's see, let me a problem for you if black holes really exist.
I don't know. I've never seen it. Maybe we saw some photo which, we can say it's a black hole, but I'm talking about...
We have very strong evidence for the existence of
Maybe this is actually a black hole, but it can be described in the other way. So we need to prove experimentally that we really need to change the causal order.
Well, I mean, isn't any gravitational effect almost that you can name, any GR effect, is a distortion of the causal order?
But that's a way to describe gravity. It doesn't mean that it is like that. It's a way to get gravity. Maybe there's another way in which you don't change the causal order and you get gravity anyway.
So you can always say something like that. You can always say we have this theory, and in this theory it looks as if the causal order is dynamical, but there's really underlying it some Aristotelian theory in which there's an absolute state of rest and there's an absolute cause, blah, 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 blah.
Why not? Aristotelian is a bad word.
Well, I just wanted to go to the extreme. You could say Galilean, but you could go farther back and say yeah. Aristotelian, so there would be an absolute.
So you believe that you believe the last one is the right one.
Well, the first one I didn't understand. If it meant the idea of induced gravity, then I don't think.
No,
that's what you want.
For sure, if I follow.
So what's the second?
Yeah. Here there is an effect. If I fall, I didn't do the calculation because this is must. I need a computer to do that. But it's not difficult because I need first quantization. I take two qubits, up they propagate. After some time, the Zitterberg-Wegener superposition spread will meet at some gate and may be that this at that gate produce an effect, a distortion of the trajectories.
And this is supposed to be gravity? What I'm not understanding is where is...
Why not? It's inertial mass and there is some distortion. Why not? Hey, what about the Verlinde proposal? It's completely wrong.
What is it?
I don't know. I'm asking
I'm
you.
Sure.
You are the expert.
I don't know. In this case, I don't know.
What about...
Someone explain to me what the proposal is.
I'm saying this. You are joking.
No. I'm serious.
No, I say that the gravity is a kind of, you know, a macroscopic effect, entropic effect, or so that is emergent.
I've not understood his proposal. So. Uh-huh. What saying gravity is emergent is one thing, but saying that it's emergent without that it's emergent from an underlying structure. Based on a fixed causal network is a different thing. Emergent is fine, right? I mean, everyone, half the world believes, or all the world believes that gravity is an emergent phenomenon in some sense.
Yeah, but
the question is that, are we to throw out the idea of a dynamical causal structure and try to get it emerged from a fixed causal structure? It seems to me, is that what your possibilities one and two presuppose that there's a fixed causal for you a circuit in fixed quantum circuit.
Let me toss the appearance
of the variable causal is not structure and a variable metric relation. Well, let's say not metric, but the appearance of a variable causal structure is misleading because underlying it there's a fixed causal structure.
Let me toss in a third, which is that there doesn't need to be an underlying causal structure.
There could be no causal
structure.
There could be some other structure.
Could be completely emergent.
Yeah, it could be some other kind of structure that has nothing to do.
Right.
But that would be four, so that would be even more radical than, in some sense, than three.
Well, not necessarily, because I mean, if you look at this, I mean, you've got a very specific topology shown here for convenience,
mm-hmm.
but you could have an underlying topology.
It doesn't have to be causal structure.
The topology itself is the information source.
But from Maurer's point of view, it's more radical, I think, because you can't even talk about quantum networks if you don't have some sort of temporal structure, some causal structure. I think
this is a work which can be done. I think you can extend this situation.
You might be able to do that, but that's a variable causal structure. But suppose you have—he's saying no causal structure at all.
No causal structure at all. Then there is not information theory anymore.
Well, no, it can be, and that's what I'll.
But
sure
let's think of two. So
oh,
I think
okay, you can call, maybe you have another structure, but you need to have a kind of partial ordering anyway, which is the equivalent of causality.
No,
you
don't even need that.
Can I understand,
not a space-time as emergent.
Yeah, no, okay. You may have an information theory in which information is going both from the output to the input and vice versa from the input to the output, but still you might need, boxes, registers, you have unique connections, information flowing from one to the other.
Well, I think that's all emergent.
All emergent from what?
From an underlying topological structure.
So, and the topology
is
something...
And if you think of the Big Bang,
uh-huh.
the origin of the universe, that's the beginning of the emergence.
So you're saying this structure is more primordial than information?
This structure is, if you want, the source of all,
yeah.
the underlying source of all of the information that we eventually represent in our...
So it's not the support of the information, but it's something which is even more elementary than information.
Yeah. Well, information I always think is being about something. All right, so, say I've got, information is all about relationships, always.
Yeah.
You know, so it's connectivity, it's...
Okay.
So... So the topology is also all about connectivity. So you can have an underlying topological structure that the discovery of the information that contains that's contained within that corresponds to the discovery of the universe. Remember, the unfolding of time is in fact the discovery of the information within that underlying structure.
Before we get into that, what was two? I still don't understand what was two.
The two is something odd. It's something which I cannot even. So that there is something which is really a mass, which is an event. An event is a piece of mass there, which, you know, make a deformation.
But this is starting to go towards what I'm suggesting, because what you're really saying is in the topology, in that
underlying
structure,
right. Yeah.
You actually, it's the structure that's sitting in there that's already built in, contains some of the information which gives rise to what you eventually recognize.
Where is gravity coming from?
Like, for example, here, you know, I have this path, which here you see it goes faster than light, and then it goes. So, for example, I can build up a black hole. That is, I gave these examples last year. You remember that there was Einstein on the skateboard. And there was a black hole here. It's just a very, very long gate. So you like that?
Couldn't escape from it.
Yeah. And Einstein was so happy. Yeah, but this is actually very hard to work with, this hypothesis. It's the most difficult one. I don't have a starting point for it. The other two cases, the first one I know what to do. The third one looks very hard,
This is modifying the causal structure.
I'm modifying the causal structure.
But you're not making it dynamic.
Yes. I'm saying, no, it's not dynamic. There is a mass.
So this corresponds, I mean, there is a very old point of view in people thinking about quantum gravity. It was especially promoted by Rosenfeld, which says we should not quantize space-time. We should not quantize the metric at all. Only quantum fields should be quantized.
Yes.
So in that sense, you could have something that in a certain sense would be a dynamical causal structure, but it wouldn't be quantum dynamical. Maybe that's what... So there'd be... You wouldn't have to sum over different ones, so to speak. There would be just one fixed space-time metric, or in this case, one fixed causal structure that would work for all time and everything. Although it wouldn't be sort of it wouldn't be set out in advance, you couldn't write down in advance what it was. There's still only one. So maybe that's what this corresponds to. So in the end, you're not quantizing gravity. There are no gravitons, for instance.
No, here, no, there are not.
So I think it's open whether or not that works.
There's a lot of
arguments against it.
I think no
definitive proof that it
If there is any experimental demonstration and one of these three hypotheses is wrong, I would love it. Because, you know, every line is a life, a life of work. So before even considering the possibility, I want to be sure.
You know, I mean, I think three is the only one that really has
a... The third one is
the... It's the one that has a real chance.
I think also Lucian thinks that the third one is the right one. I am astonished by the huge dimension that it comes out, because it's the tensor of the tensor. So it's something, you know.
Well, you must not think of Hilbert spaces. But if you do think about, if you think of causal sets, which are more general than what you're doing, because we're allowing much more general kinds of connections, the dimensions grow unbelievably fast, right? The number of causal, it's a super exponential growth.
It's a super exponential, right?
It's not just, it's a super, it's not an exp.
It's exp.
Well, it's not that fast.
Even worse.
It's not that fast. No, it's nowhere near that fast. So the number of causal, it's worse than that in a sense. At the classical, if you just count causal sets, we're not doing quantum theory yet. If you count causal sets, then the number of causal sets on n elements is roughly 2 to the n squared over 4. And there's some subleading terms which are themselves super exponential, but you can't even notice them relative to the two.
But that's just
the
because it's that you would use to represent a specific manifold.
That's just to represent a particular one. Now, if you want to go and talk about superimposing them, if you want to talk about some associated Hilbert space, then you would have something like 2 to the. What would you actually
How have? Can I give up Hilbert spaces?
You pass integral. Right?
I don't buy the fat integral. Because, you know, there are the this last
the
one by.
Integral, you can recover Hilbert spaces.
Oh, yes. It's some yeah, you can recover the Hilbert space, but, you know, I don't buy the path integral with Gassmann variables. All these kind of things I don't like. I like to do things concretely, you know, things that I can measure, I know. Otherwise, you know, I can invent maybe a device to make a theory, and then, you know, it's just a speculation or whatever.
The origin of fermions is a sort of...
The path integral comes
thing, but
is orthogonal to my because the path integral comes from the quantization, right? So we want to quantize classical mechanics to get quantum. Here we have quantum theory from scratch.
No, I think the path integral is the basic input to quantum mechanics. I think that's what quantum mechanics is telling us, that the right way to describe nature is through something like a path integral, what I would call a history's formulation of quantum mechanics.
Okay, then.
Think of having an underlying graph.
But I'm doing with something which I can never use Grassmann variables. I'm not using Grassmann variables.
Grassmann variables
still,
only with fermions.
No, wait a minute. I'm using fermions, and there are no Grassmann variables here. Much better.
But you can do, if you do fermions as particle structures, then no Grassmann variables enter. Maybe that's what you're doing.
Yeah, but in the Lagrangian, you have to write Grassmann variables.
I don't think anyone knows this rigorously, but for sure. But that, you know, for there's always a field representation and a particle representation. If you adopt a field representation for bosons,
and what is the classical field corresponding to the fermion,
and a particle representation for fermions, then Grassmann variables don't enter.
Uh-huh. So I can make a path integral
without
Grassmann variables.
Yes.
That's very unusual to me. I've never seen it. Can you suggest me a reference? I'm very interested. This is not the standard thing that they teach at school.
The closest I know, well, there is a paper, yes, I can't remember the name. There's a paper by Giorno Lassinio.
Giorno Lassinio.
Which is... It's not quite what I'm saying now, but it's something that also does fermions without Grassmann variables. So he writes the Cas integral as a real integral. He would like it using some sort of spin a half kind of thing.
That's very good.
Some sort of Poisson process.
So it's not the quantization rule.
No, it's not a quantization rule in that sense, in the sense that you dislike. But it's a description of trying to describe a fermionic field,
right.
A second quantized fermion system in terms of a path integral over some sort of.
Okay, but then you have the path integral. Here is the same. The path integral is just a translation of information flowing with simultaneous path. It's parallel universe, whatever. It's the same.
So. That's fine. So then you like it in that sense.
Yeah, then I like it. It's
okay.
Not the quantization rule.
It's not a quantization rule.
I don't need a Lagrangian, I don't need these things, I don't need to...
No, you can't have a Lagrangian. It wouldn't be surprising if there's no exact...
No, but my point is that every time I want to do something...
No Lagrangian, I think there should be no Lagrangian in the sense that there's no classical equations of motion associated to this.
Okay, then this path integral is just quantum.
I'm not sure about what Giorno Lassinio said, but this is the kind of path integral I have in mind for causal sets.
Yeah. No, because my point is that every time you want to put something more than quantum theory, you have to say, is it real? Something that I can measure, I can make an experiment, or is just, you know, the speculation that I do and try to see if something comes out.
We're not going to be doing any experiments with quantum gravity effects.
The things you're talking about are not very sensitive. So,
yeah, but in principle, also I'm saying in principle, I mean, I must be able to
refer
to.
But there's also this.
Not even in principle?
Well, not in this universe.
In which sense?
Well, in the sense that, for example, if you were to say, I've got gravitons, that the cross-section of a graviton on any apparatus that we could build is so small that in the lifetime of the universe you would never expect to detect one. So to be able to detect individual quanta is just not feasible.
No, but I'm saying, for example, you cannot, you know, work at Planck scale mass, but maybe you can, you know, this renormalization effect can be seen in some small shifts, some high energy, whatever. In principle, I have something.
Yes, there should be certain experimental consequences. But to say that that's a very different thing.
It's all indirect.
I mean, that's true of all physical theories. You know? I don't think it adds very much to say that. But it doesn't narrow down any possibilities. It doesn't include anything to say that. Except maybe some completely crazy theories. Mm-hmm. No one, you know, like, open up the Bible to page if you want an answer or something like that. And maybe it excludes. I suppose even that's a testable theory, perhaps. I don't know. But a much stronger thing is what you sounded like you were saying, which is like the basic elements out of which you build your theory must have a direct experimental meaning.
Mm-hmm.
That's a much stronger demand, and I don't think it's a fair demand, and I don't think that you could argue that you're meeting or that anyone...
Let me say it differently. Suppose that you are changing the rules a little bit, like, you know, you have some causal connection that can be... And then you discover that you have to rewrite the field theory, and you have some very, you know, tiny effect. And this effect maybe occurs that you have a proton which disappears once every 10 to the 10, 80 protons, whatever. You can build up an experiment, and you see the proton disappearing, whatever. But there must be a field theoretical outcome that I can check in the lab.
Absolutely, yes.
Otherwise,
that's
if it's only... it's something different from quantum theory, it must be something there different from quantum theory, what it is.
I have a very strange reaction to it. If I look at the details of the mathematics, I say, oh, this is very nice, this is just the kind of thing that people should be doing, trying to explore. And then there's the words that you put on it, which I hate. I have the same reaction as Shelley Goldstein. The words are everything is information, everything is... I don't see what that has to do.
Yeah, but Shelley Goldstein actually is doing not quantum theory. That's the problem, eh?
So
you know,
this
is actually something that everybody is confused about. The Bohm theory describes the Schrödinger equation, first quantization. Second quantization, no way. I asked my friend Girardi, and he said, you know, gates are made of electrons. I said, come on. So I want to make a Bohm theory in second quantization of a quantum circuit. I have to go to electrons.
Well, that's
maybe his view,
but that's not the... There's a lot of Bohmians who don't
think
that view. They're working hard to develop a field theory version.
Shlomo Goldstein wrote
a paper. In their office.
I want to be rude with him because I'm saying it's a recorded, so he can see. Shlomo Goldstein wrote a paper entitled "Quantum Information and Bohm," and then I look on the PDF. By searching, and I look for information, it was only on the title. So, I'm sorry, I think that the problem,
that he's doing it.
Is not covariant, and there is no second quantization, which is worse. And people always think that Bohm theory is quantum theory. It's not. It's quantum mechanics first quantization. Namely, quantization rules.
Well... I mean, I think...
So, where is the ontology that...
I agree with you that the failure of it to be...
And it's not covariant.
Well, covariant is a very serious... Most people think that that's a very serious problem.
And both things...
If you accept that, I think there's probably can be.
No, but this is.
I mean, in particular, Warren Strega.
This is why.
Is doing this work. So I think there's a good chance that it could be promoted to be a field theory version. Of course, field theory has its own difficulties, even leaving aside the Bohmian version of it. But if you're willing to accept a distinguished reference frame, then at least in flat space, I think maybe you could do a field theory. But what you'll never do, at least I think this is in some sense its worst failing, is that the kind of thing you're talking about or that I'm thinking about, which are discrete, space-time discrete things, I think Bohm theory is completely lost there. Because it's all based on this guidance formula, which is the Schrodinger equation,
you know,
in a continuous.
You can make the Bohm theory of the first quantization circuit, which is very odd. You can do that.
Yeah.
That's actually a good exercise. I want to put a student on it and publish a paper so people will realize that this is Bohm, is not second quantization. Because in second quantization,
I think you could probably make an infinite number of them, but how would you pick out any one of them?
No, okay, you can work with an infinite dimensional space, which is not Hilbert, but is geometrical space. So you have a six-dimensional space for two particles, a nine-dimensional space for three particles, and then an infinite dimensional space for every possible number of particles.
Yes, absolutely.
And then it's not covariant.
That's the usual Bohm theory.
Yeah, but
I'm talking about your quantum circuit, which has only discrete.
Oh, no, no, this is, okay, I will have discrete positions. In space.
So discrete positions in space should be enough to ruin the normal one. So what do you do in place of the guidance equation?
Oh, I think that I can recover from the unitary transformation as a phase shift. I can get the potential. I think it's very similar. I'm saying I have a discrete version of the usual Schrodinger equation. Why not?
Oh, you have a discrete, you want a discrete version of the guidance equation?
I think it can be done.
It's
I have a
continuing.
phase shifts.
Maybe. I'd like to see
it. It's just a game. It's an exercise. But it is a way to see why it cannot be done in the second quantization case.
Why it cannot be done in the second point? In that case, you have a space of
because you don't have a classical field as a function of the position, but you have an operator field.
No, you don't do it that way. You do it in the Schrodinger representation.
Yeah, but even in the Schrodinger picture with infinitely many possible parts.
Schrodinger representation, I think.
In the position representation.
Position representation.
So
that means the field.
We need infinitely many dimensions in the geometrical space.
Yes, sure.
And then covariance is a big problem. Because Lorentz transformation is infinite dimension, right?
But they've given up covariance already.
Okay, but then
so they don't have.
Yeah, but the problem is that this comes from. The notion of objectivity. You want something objective, you want to kick out the subject, the observer, and then what you get back, the revenge of the observer, comes from the window of relativity, which is broken. Because relativity is the observer.
Well, that's another thing we can argue about.
Yeah.
But what I was saying is, I don't see the real part I was trying to make is that I would like to divorce the words you use to describe what you're doing from what you're doing, because I don't see what it has to do with information. Really what you're just saying is that there's some sort of Hilbert spaces living on, you have some sort of abstract graphical network, which is a partial order, carries a partial order, or is a partial order. And you're putting Hilbert spaces on the links or something like that, of that order, and you're making some sort of dynamical law to describe, now we have to say exactly what the evolution, I'm not sure, but something like a wave function in that Hilbert space. So it's all just quantum. It's a quantum theory on a given causal set or something similar to a causal set. Why do we have to say?
Yeah,
what
they are
unitary, but what this doesn't have.
Yeah.
Well,
you
are not sure it's basically.
What?
What did you say?
The boxes are unitary.
Right?
The boxes are unitary, but they're acting on something.
Yeah.
So
something is sort of one thing that's on the bottom. So it's not on every node there's no Hilbert space.
It's a tensor product of a Hilbert space for each one for Y.
For wire, that's what I said.
I said on the links.
Yeah.
On the links, oh, okay.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So, but what you don't have in this is state reduction. So
no.
So there's no
no acquisition, no working with information,
no.
Any information that goes in the bottom.
No, you don't have.
Yeah, this is only propagation, propagation,
yeah.
And then the observer is the preparer, he prepares the field, and he observes the field at the end.
But
that's the usual quantum theory.
Well,
it's usual.
But
the,
yes,
but
yes,
so
but the usual quantum theory actually doesn't tell us about our real space-time, because if I just look between observations,
mm-hmm.
then I actually don't know what's there. It's all counterfactuals. Right?
Sure.
All right.
But
so,
in fact, it must be. That's field theory. It's counterfactual.
But what you're raising is an issue that's an issue for all of quantum theory. It has nothing to do with this particular kind of quantum theory. So all I'm trying to say, first of all, is that this is some quantum theory. But to say that it's all information is neither here nor there. I mean, you could say about all quantum theory it's just information,
mm-hmm.
if you like to say it, or if you don't like to say it, which I don't. You don't have to say that. I don't see that this changes the story one way or another.
It's versus,
that's all I'm saying.
It's versus quantum mechanics, particles, and quantization rules. Information without particles.
Well, it's just a quantum theory that's not got by
without
quanti-
space.
It's not got by quantizing.
People
are working all the time with spin system, and half the people go over to IQC, half the people there are working, or here, you know, 10% of the people are working with these spin systems. They're not gotten by quantizing any classic. They're not quantization rules. They're not got by quantizing any
mm-hmm.
classical Lagrangian dynamics. That's fine, but that doesn't mean that they're just information.
Well, no.
That's a particular viewpoint on.
But the viewpoint is very, as you can see,
is
very effective, right?
Information.
It's effective. You just get from information flow is Dirac.
I mean,
that's
the
all.
Magnet,
no need of you know working out the gamma matrices and all the things and.
And I understand that from a, but, you know what they're doing with their experiments and attempts to build quantum computers and so on is actually preparing the initial state and doing the measurements.
They're doing information processing.
They're doing information
that's
processing where they're actually looking to gain real information depending on state reduction takes
you
place.
You have those two pictures.
Oh, but I can make state reduction.
I can
you know, just cut the wire somewhere and put the observer there and then.
Well, no, but put
I don't
it,
want
that,
to.
Just, no, but that state, it's not the observer somewhere. That state reduction, this goes back to my comment.
The observer can
geometry,
be anywhere.
Geometry is, if they go to Zurich's notion, it comes about because the information is now made accessible through
mm-hmm.
state reduction, is made accessible through sampling of any
oh,
small
well, you're
portion
talking
of
about
the environment.
Objectivity of information with many observers, so that's
yes.
another issue,
yeah.
which is totally irrelevant from.
Well, I don't think it is when it comes
no,
to understanding the linkage to to gravity, to space
right.
and geometry. I think that's where the linkage needs to be made.
So you want to have a huge amount of redundancy in the information such that everybody in the world can see.
It's that redundancy which gives rise to the geometry
okay.
that we perceive.
Okay, but this is an issue which can be addressed. This is standard quantum theory, you can do that. Zurich has many ideas
yeah.
about
well,
that, and they are, I'm saying, reasonable, why not? I believe they are right. But that's, I'm saying, this is completely
that's not
in agreement.
Rise to the geometry.
You can
the
use
geometry
Zurich.
Is all there.
Well,
this is a different question. This is the question, why are there macroscopic beings who draw geometrical diagrams on paper and do physics and so on? That's a different question. It's not what creates the geometry.
For me, the
it's
point
our,
is...
That's what creates in our mind the geometry.
It's, yeah, but it's not...
No,
it's
not because the whole theory posits the geometry in the very beginning. That's my exactly the same comment I was trying to make in the beginning.
So I say geometry is...
You're not really
mostly
deriving causal relations here. You're positing causal relations.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm saying, I'm describing...
So
quantum theory
to
is
the extent, yeah.
Yeah.
So
sure.
it's not that those things are emergent. They're
right. Yeah, but still, we have not
those
proof.
Those are the physical things.
Still, I've not seen a proof.
When people say information is physical, that's what they're talking about.
You
there's
should.
All that stuff there.
You are the most entitled one to make a short proof that we need dynamical causal relation. Why don't you do it?
How would I prove
I would love. Okay. Then, so then there is a problem. But we don't need it.
I mean, that's the question between
this is
possibility one and three.
Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Yes.
So and I think this is the interesting one. It's,
right.
So the question that you ask is also the first possibility. The question that you're asking there is it possible that I can have an underlying causal set which is completely given, just there, but the emergent stuff is different. Looks like it has a different causal it has a different set of causal relations than the underlying one. And you were saying no, it doesn't exist. And you say the third possibility is what you should choose. And I don't know. I think this is a very interesting question. I think it's really an interesting question.
If I can find just a tiny reason to choose one instead of the other, I think it should be a very important paper to be written. But yes. Precise.
Well, I mean, there is a tiny reason. I
precise,
think it's conclusive, but there is
proved.
A reason.
Proved.
For three rather than one.
There is a reason which has some force, I think.
Which is, the reason cannot be, I believe in Einstein. The reason cannot be, I believe in Einstein theory. This is not a good reason. So Einstein theory can be wrong, can be right.
I don't know what that. I mean, we have to believe something.
No, we
didn't believe.
We didn't prove Einstein experimentally for very strong gravitational fields. Experimentally,
we will soon.
We'll soon
know one way or the other.
I want to see before, but
it won't be.
Anyway, we cannot publish the paper that I want to.
Well, from gravitational waves.
We want to see the gravitational field near a black hole.
No, he wants to see strong.
I want to see the very strong gravitational field near a small black hole. I'm not saying a tiny.
You don't mean you're not happy with the solar mass?
And to see that there.
You mean
this is not strong gravity. The solar system.
Solar mass black hole is not strong.
I'm talking about the gravity at the beginning of the universe, or the gravity you got a very strong one.
You mean quantum scale?
Or to see, I've said the gravity of a black hole, or a very strong, say small black hole, very condensed.
It's going to have to be a very small black hole because if you take
a
stellar sized black hole, the gravity at the event horizon.
Yeah, this is normal gravity. Yeah, so. Yeah, you're right.
Oh, I'm a question.
You
want to go in?
Well, it depends what
so
you mean.
What
we compare
we,
to the
we don't
Planck
know
scale.
If gravity is described.
I take strong to mean another thing. I take it to mean that you're seeing nonlinear terms.
So the point is that
in the Einstein equation,
we are not sure that
the
theory is true for every strength.
If she wanted the Planck scale, then of course it would be.
No, the Planck scale. No, I think it's much.
But to see the nonlinear terms is a much stronger, is a much.
But anyway, the answer is that you believe in the Einstein theory.
That's not the end. I was going to give a completely different answer. But it does require you to believe that this has gravity, right? It does require you to believe things which you can directly measure, which is that. So if I move this cup, the gravitational field will move along with it. So I have to do a Coulomb experiment. But it won't be. So it's this very old Gedanken experiment.
Yeah, but this will work also on the first case here. You will have the same effect in the first case.
I'll have the effect in any case. This is a real physical. In principle, a real physical effect. It's probably impossible to do the experiment realistically. But the idea is to set up some sort of quantum event, some closed system that will, isolated system that will, when a quantum event happens or doesn't happen, like the Schrodinger cat or whatever. And if it does happen, then the mechanism moves the cup here. And if it doesn't, then the mechanism doesn't move the cup here. So the idea, so this shows us that we have to consider two different, in fact, there's a sort of glorified version of that. I wrote a paper with Daniel Sudarsky about this, where we made the event be the formation of a black hole and not a black hole, depending on some quantum effect. So you get radically different, in that case the entropy was the issue, but the main thing is you get radically different gravitational fields depending on this quantum event. Now, if you believe, if you take quantum mechanics seriously, then if you take the randomness inherent, then there's no way of forecasting in advance which is going to happen.
So
you get, if you don't believe in the reduction, you have a Schrodinger cat problem. If you do believe in the reduction somehow as a real process, you may not have that problem, but you still have a probabilistic choice between two different geometries. So in that sense, the geometry has to be dynamical. There can be no fixed a priori.
Well, that's not.
But you could do a delayed choice and end up with a superliminal
But I don't think that that's the choice between one and three that you're talking about. Because, so no, I think no. The point that about possibility one is that the geometry would not be the so the geometry that would be relevant would not be the geometry of the underlying of this lattice. But then that's
no. Say the geometry is event counting, and so the metric comes from event counting, and you see that there is a distortion of trajectory over the,
yeah, so
the causal network.
Exactly, so the causal network is what it is.
Is what it is.
But the fact that there are two things changes.
Well, that's true, yeah, I know.
So it is dynamic, as you said. But the question is, it doesn't come about because of the stuff that's happening, the information flow, if you want to formulate that in the language, or is it coming about because the underlying computation is changing? And I think that's
I don't see how could anyone ever disprove such a thing. I mean, if you come and say...
No, you cannot.
It's not easy. It's not easy.
You write down a theory.
Even classically, how could you ever
The point is that you cannot... This cannot be in the literature for the simple reason that if you take the Dirac field, there is no effect. You have to go to the causal network structure, the discrete case. Otherwise, you don't see the effect.
I mean, it's like trying to say, it's something like asking, could I ever prove that the topology of space-time is not R4? you say, oh, yeah, sure, I can do it. I can send, imagine like a practical curve. suppose on a global scale, it's not R4. So I try to send two people, and they go in two directions, and they come back and meet, or something like that. You can imagine, or I do these observations, and I see... You know, people have looked for observational evidence of non-trivial topology. You'll see special circles. Yeah, how does it go? I forget exactly. But there's some
signature. You'll see circles opposite different places on the sky indicating the same pattern.
You'll see a repeating pattern in the simplest case. Someone can say, oh yeah, you think that's what it means, but really we have R4, and there's really some special kind of theory which we don't understand, which has caused things to repeat in this weird way.